Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. The regular season is underway and we're here to talk about it. How are you doing, Eric?
This is an in-season podcast. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So pretty happy there's real baseball, but also spring was part of this, but baseball is an everyday thing now. And then just basically underground for 6 months.
Essentially, yeah. And the first four games, we'll get into this, a really big reminder of that, because of that everyday nature of baseball, sometimes there's a slump kind of things.
Yeah. And people generally handle slumps very measured online, and it's never bad. So it was a fun couple days, but yeah, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we'll break that down. We have Dodgers Rewind. We have questions from Craig after this.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Eric, would you say it's time for everyone to panic?
Yes.
So not only is it just, small sample size, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but three of the games we're going to be overreacting to, or people who are want to overreact to, were at Coors Field.
Right. Well, yeah, there's always the expectation you go into Coors Field time to pad those numbers,
Well, it's not, pad the numbers. Games are weird at Coors Field. Weird things happen at Coors Field.
No, always. You're always, you have to be ready for anything, I guess, in a way. And it's why, the Dodgers are hey, we're going to carry 16 pitchers to start the season because we start in Coors. And you know what? I get it. It's a weird place. Do what you got to do. So the funny part about this, the weekend was weird, but I will say this. I'll get into this a little bit, but my weekend regarding these games played out as well as I could have hoped in terms of coverage, because I was mostly offline Sunday, which was the best time to be offline and that sort of thing. But so the Dodgers, they go into the season, they sign Freddie Freeman, and then they're like, wow, this offense looks really, really good. They were already projected for the most runs scored in Major League Baseball this year by Pecota, and I believe also, I don't remember if Fangraphs has runs scored, runs allowed. Maybe Zips what did, and that's what it was. They signed Freddie Freeman, so they're better. And then they go into Coors, and they have four extra base hits in three games. And the one home run was by Austin Barnes, which of course everyone guessed. That was a bomb, by the way, 453 feet. But the offense was just weird. They were battling or whatever you want to say on Friday opening day. But they scored five runs in the fourth inning and then not at all the rest of the game, but they still won. The next 30 innings, they scored seven runs. And then this is into the first game in Minnesota. That game was a close game late. And then they scored six runs in the eighth to win that one. So it's just this weird, it's again, only four games, but it's a weird distribution of runs so far and not conducive to, sort of quelling the worry warts, as it were. Right. And to be fair, some with decent to good reason. It's just funny how it sort of plays out sometimes.
So, and you made a tweet about this yesterday. Where the production's coming from is also a little unexpected, in that it's kind of coming from the bottom of the order. So especially Gavin Lux has looked really good.
Yeah, he's basically hit eighth or ninth each game. I think I think, oh yeah, because Austin Barnes has started a couple games, including, we're recording this before Wednesday's, Wednesday morning in LA series finale. Austin Barnes is catching again today. He's hitting ninth, so Lux is eighth, but Chris Taylor's also been down there either seventh or eighth.
And speaking, and, I was about to say, maybe not especially. Gavin Lux is one of definitely the brighter note, but Chris Taylor also hitting the, yeah, the leather off the ball.
He has, I believe, three of the either six or seven total extra base hits by the Dodgers so far. And so, yeah, he's been really good. Both of them have been really good. But so Lux, you know, we talked about this with the Pollock trade. To get Kimbrel, that obviously, you know, it sort of depleted a little bit of like the depth in terms of, is this the Dodgers' best lineup? You know, that kind of a thing. But then it also was a, it made sure that like Gavin Lux has like regular playing time, you know, and so far that's been the case. Like he's in the lineup today at second base. That means he will have started all six games. Five of those have been at second base. The way they're doing this in the early going with Chris Taylor's elbow, they don't want to move him around infield outfield style right now to sort of ease up on the elbow. So he doesn't, I believe Dave Roberts has referred to this as they didn't want to change his arm angles a lot right now. Just basically giving him the same type of a throw each time. So they're keeping him kind of in left field for now, which opens up second base for Gavin Lux. Lux did start in left field one game in Coors. Chris Taylor did not start that game. They had Edwin Rios one of the games at DH. But Lux has been really good. He's 5 for 12. He's leading the team with four RBIs. He had a sacrifice fly that he hit like, I think it was like 106 miles an hour off the bat that was basically caught at the wall yesterday for one of the RBIs. But His average exit velocity, again, four games, take what you will, but 91.5 miles an hour. It's been between 87 and 89.8 the last 3 years in his time during in the majors. So he's just playing generally better. So that's a thing. But like, just I was mentioning the, you know, I guess the, I don't know, the. He was like he and Chris Taylor have been like the two sort of consistent producers so far. And I think what today is the sixth game or no, fifth game of the season. I can't count. So yeah, so pretend I said five instead of six, but
I will.
The only person who hasn't started so far, including today, is Hanser Alberto. So yeah, that's Dave Roberts said, look, we're going to have essentially a regular lineup, and they kind of have so far. So that's sort of how it's played out.
So we've talked about overreacting, and it's a small sample size. So going into that, is there any area where you do have sort of real concern?
Yeah, so like Sunday's game, the Dodgers lost. I believe that was 9-4. That was a Julio Urias start. And he just hasn't looked very good so far. Like, so everyone's sort of pointing to his average velocity on his fastball. It was 91.4 miles an hour on Sunday at Coors. Last year it was 94.1 the whole season. In his last freeway series start on the middle game on Monday at Dodger Stadium, he was at 91.6. So you have to like sort of, the shortened spring plays into this a little bit. That freeway series was Urias's third spring start. You could say the Coors Field start was Urias's fourth spring start, although that game counted, which of course makes it, you know, more concerning. After I asked Dave Roberts after the freeway series start, like, is there concern? Because both he and Gonsolin, who pitched the same night, were in that like 91.5 mile an hour range, both well under what they like are usually at and usually, you know, effective at. And Robert sort of said, you know, spring still, once the regular season comes along, the adrenaline will sort of guide them through it. It sort of did for Tony Gonsolin, who was at, 94 on his Saturday start. So like he was pretty good. He was also down in that April 4 start, but with Urias, he just didn't get it back yet. And so I guess the thing there is, you know, Urias, last Monday and on Sunday, he said he's healthy and he's just not executing. Roberts said the same thing. So I guess you just have to see what happens in their next start. Urias is going to start Saturday against the Reds. But that's sort of where we're at. But so Sunday was the weird game. So the Dodgers, Friday was close. Saturday was a very close game. I think Connor Joe for the Rockies hit a home run off Blake Treinen in the eighth to win it. So that was another close game. But then Sunday was like the Rockies got up big early and it was just not as competitive. And then that was sort of the game where, you know, the Wolves were out online, as it were. But I went, Craig, of Questions from Craig fame, Craig Benami, he actually recapped Sunday's game because I went over to my cousin's house and was hanging out. And that was fun because his 5-year-old daughter was explaining to us a show she remembered, but she kept saying the name wrong. And she said Diarrhea of a Wimpy Kid, and she kept saying it like over and over again. And we were absolutely dying laughing and also thinking we have to make this as a real show. But
no, you don't. That sounds gross.
That was my concern on Sunday rather than Urias, because I was half-heartedly paying attention rather than fully focused on the game I was recapping. But yeah, that's kind of it. It's, you know, how much can you make out of 4 games? I don't really know. But that's sort of...
regardless of the, you know, iffy outcome so far, oh, it's good to have baseball back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So another weird quirk. I don't remember ever seeing this. And it's not even that big of a thing, but it just... I think I texted you about it yesterday. Joe Davis... did we talk about on the podcast last week how he's going to be calling the World Series?
I feel like I brought that up at a random spot. Yeah,
that seems right. But just in case we didn't, he's going to be calling the World Series and hit the All-Star game from his own Dodger Stadium booth this year. So very cool for him. Very well-deserved honor. He's really good. But during the Dodger game yesterday, when they do the intros where they just show like the two announcers with the backdrop of the stadium and all that from the booth, I don't remember ever seeing Joe Davis wear glasses on air, and he did, like, not again, not that big of a thing. It's just like, whoa, I looked up. I was like, wait, that's new. So yeah, we have, a new, Joe Davis has always sort of embraced like, sort of modern. I hate the way analytics is used as a pejorative, but he sort of embraced analytics, you know, in a way, and he presents it well to like a general audience. He's very good at that, but maybe he's just fully embracing the nerddom of baseball and that you have to respect it. So I love it. No. So that was one of those things, but, so we're recording on a Wednesday morning. Pretty soon here, the finale of this little 2-game interleague series in Minnesota will conclude. Clayton Kershaw, who's been healthy this spring, but the Dodgers sort of pushed him back to the fifth starter role to sort of give him as much of a spring as possible. He pitched a simulated game last week, so he basically had like 5 sort of spring starts, 4 real spring games, and then 1 simulated game. So as close to a normal spring as he had after sort of an off season of rest after his elbow stuff last year. But when he pitches on Wednesday, again, we're recording before that, just to be clear. So if he doesn't pitch, it is not Jacob's fault. or mine. This will be his 15th season pitching for the Dodgers. That's the second most in franchise history. Of the other 4 pitchers in the top 5 in Dodgers tenure, how many can Jacob name?
I'll throw some names out. I'm going to guess 2 will be right. And we'll figure it out after this. You want me to name the non-Clayton Kershaw most seasons pitched for the Dodgers, is that right?
Yep, there's so I will tell you so Kershaw's at becomes he's he moves into second with 15 years. There's the top five is everyone at 13 years and up.
Okay. What's funny is Don Sutton.
Yeah, he's number one. So he had the he had 16. He had 15 straight like Kershaw does now or will now, and then the straggler when he came back in 1988.
What's funny about that is I'm writing names down and have been kind of throughout the break and start of the episode. He was so obvious that I didn't even write him down and therefore exactly. Almost didn't guess him.
Yep.
that would have been good.
Yep.
Kenley Jansen.
So Jansen, had he resigned,
okay,
would have made yeah, into the I, top you, six.
I thought it was 13.
He's at 12.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Got it. All right. Claude Osteen.
I believe. Yeah, he is. He's at 9. Okay. So 1965 to 73. But also, let's just double check here. That's a good guess because in those 9 years, he's still seventh in innings.
Yeah.
So like he was obviously a stalwart there.
Alrighty. I played by the three strikes rule, so I have one wrong guess. Don Drysdale.
Drysdale is currently tied with Kershaw until Kershaw throws a pitch. He's at 14, 1956 to 69.
I think this is going to be a strike, but I want to get in honor of our Zach Wheat rule. I want to guess it anyways. Dazzy Vance.
So he's at 12. Okay. He just missed it. So the two, so Koufax is also at 12, just to, and Carl Erskine is at 12. The two at 13 are Johnny Padres, who started the first game at Dodger Stadium, which the 60th anniversary was 3 days ago. And then the other is Orel Hershiser. So
really? Wow.
Yeah. So he was at 12 and then left to go to Cleveland.
Right.
And then to a San Francisco team, which shall not be named. And then the Mets. And then he came back in 2000.
Yeah, I guess I have such good memory. Not memory, because, you know, I was too young to be paying attention. But, like, knowledge of the non-Dodger years that I had kind of written that out as a guess. So, cool. Good to know.
The other milestone, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this at some point, for Kershaw is, so he's at 2,670 strikeouts.
It's gonna happen today, right?
Yeah, he could. If he go, he doesn't. He doesn't even have to go complete game because there could be a lot of pass balls. But he's 26 away from tying Don Sutton for the most strikeouts in Dodgers history. So that's gonna happen at some point, and probably sometime soon.
Yeah, he saw Sasaki's perfect game and thought, you know what?
Oh, yeah.
Take this personally. I'm gonna one up it.
That happened. It's like at such a late point Saturday, like in like well past midnight.
And I was actually I think up and because listeners unaware, NPB pitcher, Japanese League pitcher, Roki Sasaki. Like struck out 19 in a perfect game and at one point threw I think it was 13 strikeouts in a row.
Yeah, yep.
And I was in the middle of following just the strikeouts in a row, not realizing, oh, it was also a perfect game.
Sure. Well, that's one of those amazing things because I didn't see it till the next morning, but it was a cool thing to wake up to just to see everyone start talking about it. But so 19 strikeouts, including 13 in a row, perfect game, great, obviously. First NPB perfect game in 28 years, but I believe he threw 105 pitches. Like that's impossible. And
near Maddux, yeah.
Yeah, that's for that many strikeouts.
He's only 20. His catcher is 18.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know the catcher part. Wow, that's amazing.
Unreal, and yeah. So
you never know when baseball is going to happen. Is basically the point there. You
future Dodger.
Always pay attention. Mm-hmm. They should try to figure out how to sort of get him by July. If they can. I don't know what the rules are.
All right. Who you got for our Dodgers rewind?
Okay. So the Dodgers are playing the Twins. So decided to go with Ken Landreau. So he's funny because he's sort of, he does community relations stuff for the Dodgers now. And he's not always, but just, he's one of those guys you sort of occasionally just see like wandering around the stadium. And it's just fun because you can just sort of pick his brain on stuff because he was around in the 80s and things. But so he played high school at Dominguez in Compton. He went to ASU and was drafted by the Angels. He was part of a 4-for-1 trade by the Angels to the Twins to get Rod Carew before the 1979 season. Part of that deal that went along with Landreau to Minnesota was Brad Havens, a pitcher who was later on the 1988 Dodgers, which is notable. Then in 1980 with the Twins, Ken Landreau had a 31-game hitting streak. He made his lone All-Star team that year. He hit .392 during the streak. It was in April and May. The streak also included one game in between. Now, it doesn't count as a game in the streak, but he played the last inning on defense, but also he pinch hit before that, but he was walked. And because streaks can continue in situations like that, so that was, he already had 11 games on the streak and then added 20 more after that. The Dodgers acquired him right before the 1981 season. And when I say right before, it was 10 days before opening day. It's like, I know the Dodgers traded Pollock for Kimbrel, right? Like a few days before opening day. Those don't happen a lot. I think, I remember they got like, they traded like Milton Bradley. And I think they traded for Milton Bradley and I want to say Jason Worth within like a week of opening day in 04. That was kind of a weird thing. It's always weird to see late spring transactions like that in for players who are like essentially who come in to start. You could see it for like fringe guys maybe, but not necessarily starters. But so this was 1981. It was a 3-for-1 deal. Going to Minnesota in that deal from the Dodgers was another future 1988 Dodger, Mickey Hatcher. Landreau was essentially like the Dodgers starting center fielder for the next five seasons and also for a good chunk of 86. In those 5 years from 81 to 85, he had a 103 OPS plus. He averaged 20 doubles and 11 homers and 21 steals. He had about a 1.6 war per year in that time. But you have to also remember that 81 was strike shortened, so tilt that upwards maybe just a tad. He played through the end of 1987. He had 10.3 career war, 8.5 of that was with the Dodgers. He had a 99 OPS plus in 11 years in the majors. After the 1987 season, Fred Clair was elevated to GM earlier that year after the Al Campanis interview on Nightline. It was very, very unfortunate. Fred Clair, as you might recall, had a very busy offseason in the 87 into 88 and made some very substantial moves. But at some point in October, they said they weren't going to re-sign, basically, Ken Landreau and Phil Garner. Landreau was making, the year before, he made $737,500, which was one of the highest paid players on the team, I believe. Hershiser and Valenzuela were making more, and Guerrero, I guess. Phil Garner was at $450,000. This is from the LA Times, from Fred Clair. Ken was a key figure during the championship seasons of 81, 83, and 85. He's saying the NL West winning years. Obviously, they won the World Series in 81. And all of us appreciate the role he played on those teams. We wish Phil and Ken the very best. So he's one of those. It's just a weird thing to sort of officially say, we're out on these guys, you know, like when someone becomes a free agent or whatever. He actually played, Landreau did, he played in the minors with the Orioles in 88 and AAA. He came back to the Dodgers in 89, but only played in AAA Albuquerque. Then he retired. Like I said, he's been in community relations with the team for a while and just sort of still around, which is, it's always a cool thing to sort of see former Dodgers just sort of being still in the organization, sort of keeping the link to the past alive. It's always good. Now he, Ken Landreau caught the final out of the 1981 World Series in center field in Game 6 in Yankee Stadium. My question to you, Jacob, who recorded the final outs for the Dodgers in their two World Series championships after Landreau in 81?
So, thing I hate about questions about 88 is that from someone like me, you know, was two when it occurred, sure, didn't become a Dodger fan until much later, is that it's so, the history is so dominated by game one that I know little. I know Oral started game two. I know that. And that's about
How was that game two?
I knew that too. I knew that too. Yeah. And I, you know, and there's a handful of names I can name, but I like, where did they play, et cetera. So I will
give you a hint for 88 since we're on there. Oral also started game five. He finished game five.
Yeah. So I'm almost sad you gave me the hint. So we'll get Urias and Austin Barnes out of the way.
Okay. That is that's correct for 2020.
And then my guess was going to be Oral and Socha.
Okay, so you were on the right track.
Yep.
Except Socha hurt his knee.
That's right. I was just about to correct myself.
to the point where they had, like, I think Gilberto Reyes at the ready, and they were going to replace Socha on the roster had the series continued. But instead, he was pitching to backup extraordinaire that year, Rick Dempsey. Who I believe is an age 40 season. In our notes, the links that have the answers are just pictures of celebrations of the final outing. If you didn't click on them, but
I would never.
And no, I mean after the fact.
Oh,
I mean, I'll include those in the show notes because they're great. Fun.
You know what else is fun?
I do.
It's time for
Questions from Craig.
Five plus questions from our friend Craig Manami. You ready for the trivia portion?
I am. Let's do it. I have to do better than last week. I know that.
I hope you do well. I the two questions this week I liked a lot. Challenging, but also I didn't feel totally embarrassed.
Right.
This week
they were winnable questions. Yeah. Sorry.
This week, Dodgers will honor both Jackie Robinson on the 75th anniversary of his first Major League Baseball game and Maury Wills with his own bobblehead night. Both Robinson and Wills were known for stealing bases, so this week's trivia questions will be about the art of taking bases as a Dodger. All right, you ready?
I like that Craig said taking bases there. That's funny.
I've mentioned this before. It's one of my favorite part of questions, Craig, is the synonyms Craig has to look up when he writes these trivia questions.
No, he does a great job. We don't appreciate him enough.
According to the 2022 Dodger Media Guide, six Dodgers since 1947 have led the National League in stolen bases at least once. One of them, Trey Turner, did it as both a Dodger and a National in 2021. Can Eric name the other five?
So, as someone who generally, not always, because you sometimes do it, but my general rule on Craig's questions is I cut and paste them into our notes, so we just have them in one spot, you know, as we're recording. I try not to look at them, although that's very hard to do sometimes, other than just to make sure it's like formatted properly or whatever. I do occasionally glance, and all I saw on this was six Dodgers since 1947 have led the NL in stolen base. I didn't even see the next sentence about Trey Turner. My first thought was, well, Trey Turner's one. I get that one. But automatically cut down in my prime. Okay, so 1947. So we got Maury Wills.
Yep.
I want to say I don't know if Craig put this in there. I think he led the league six times.
He did. I have the individual seasons.
I believe it was six in a row, if I'm not mistaken. But
it was 60 through 65.
So, and then Davey Lopes.
How many times did he do it?
Oh man,
these are bonuses. I won't.
Okay, so I think he only did it twice.
Correct, 75 and 76.
And then. Okay, so there's three more.
there is.
Okay, so the 50s generally, not a lot of steals in the 50s. So I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna go back for a second and say Jackie Robinson.
Yep, 47 and 49.
Okay, I did not realize he did it twice. All right, so two more, and this is going to be tough. D. Gordon.
Yep, 2014.
D. Strange Gordon, yeah. Okay. Then Juan Pierre?
Nope.
He didn't do it. Oh, jeez. Brett Butler?
Nope.
Rafael Furcal?
Nope.
All right, well,
I'll give you a season. 1952.
Oh, then I guess Jim Gilliam?
Nope. Hall of Famer.
Pee-wee?
Yep, Pee-wee Reese with 30.
I
was staring at the name. I'm like, I don't think he's ever going to guess Pee-wee Reese. And despite, you know, how well-known the name is.
You would think with a name like Pee-wee, like, you would just assume he has to be fast. Like, but if, and then I just never, wow, that's a surprise. I like that.
Since 1960, 8 Dodgers have stolen at least 30 bases at least 3 times. Who are those Dodgers? Hint, the last 3, all of whom stole 30 or more bases at least 3 times, did it well into the Jacob era, which really should become an official baseball term. Since 1960, I'm just going to reiterate that.
Okay. So Raul Mondesi as the first 2 members of the 30-30 club for the Dodgers. He's one.
Nope, he only did it twice.
He's not one. He only did it twice. What a jerk. What an absolute jerk. So Maury Wills.
Yep.
Davey Lopes.
Yep. Each Steve did it 7 Sachs. Times. Each did 7 times. Steve Sachs did it 6 times. You're in order
Steve
so
Six. Far. Steve
Sachs.
Yeah. And then, okay, so
Steve
then...
Steve Sachs steals.
And then he sells seashores by the seashores or what. Anyway, Brett Butler.
I did it 3 times.
All right, so we're at... Oh, man. Now we got to think about this.
You're missing 4 names, just to let you know.
Missing 4, okay. Now, what's... Juan Pierre?
Yes, sorry.
07-09?
What? I'm reading ahead to, we mentioned Craig's thesaurus action, and he's got a great one for the next question.
Oh, okay. Let's just think about this for a second. So when they traded the...
You're missing 2 players with 3 seasons and 1 player with 4 seasons.
4 seasons. Like a hotel. Who am I missing with 4? So it's probably... Willie Davis?
Yep, with 4 between 62 and 70. Don't have the exact seasons, but...
Yeah, and then the other 2. See, I didn't think like Matt Kemp got to it 3 times, so that's why I'm not saying him. But you
consider that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know he had the 40 steal 2011.
Yeah, so Matt Kemp is 1. He had 8 and 9 as well.
Wait, what?
2008 and 2009.
Yeah. So I am blanking on the other one. Do you have years?
Yes. 2002 to 2004.
See? Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second. This is... Oh, now this is bad.
He has the most famous steal of anyone on this list.
Yeah, of course. I should have had this earlier, but it's Dave Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Damn it. Nice one. Nice one, Craig.
Since 1900, six players in their Dodger careers stole over 100 bases and hit over 100 home runs. Who are these players who had winged feet and thunder in their bats?
Oh, that's great. Matt Kemp for sure.
Yep, with 170 stolen bases and 203 home runs.
Damn. Since 1900. So let's go to Duke Snider.
No.
Didn't get to 100 steals. Jackie Robinson.
Jackie with 197 stolen bases and 137 home runs.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy. Wow, I don't think he got to 100 steals. This is making me angry. let's go back to the Mondesi well.
Yep, of 104. Wow, I can't say numbers today. 140 stolen bases, 163 home runs.
Okay, and then I don't even I'm just going to say it just maybe, but I don't think you would have got to this, but Pedro Guerrero.
Nope.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the steal totals for the three remaining players as you've gotten the bottom three. So 335, 232, 203.
The 335 is worrisome. okay. Let's think this through here. So did Willie Davis do it?
He did. 154 home runs to go with the 335 steals.
Yeah. And then what was the other one? 230 something and
232. Largely a longevity. Wow. I'm giving up. I'm done. he played for the Dodgers for a long time. How about that?
Yeah. But I don't. This is so dumb. Okay, I'm just going to say, because I don't think this is true, but just because I'm tapped out, but Bill yep. Russell?
Nope. So I'm striking you out. Pee-wee yep, Reese?
Of course. I had shut off the Brooklyn part. Oh,
and I'll actually give you one more hint, and I think you'll get it. The remaining name. Since 1900.
Oh, so
go that far back.
Oh, Zach Wheat?
There you go.
I didn't remember him getting to 100 home runs.
131 home runs.
Very nice.
Occasionally, the last question, a player will get caught trying to steal. Since 1940, name the eight Dodgers who have been caught at least 75 times as a Dodger.
So I remember, so famously, because I didn't know or care at the time, Brett Butler in 1991 stole 38 bases, but he was caught 28 times, so I'm going to definitely say him.
Yeah, yep, he is on this list. Your hint is that everyone has already been mentioned, has been an answer already, except for one player.
Okay, so the other thing is, so Maury Wills and Davey Lopes had tremendous success rates, but also such a high volume that I'm pretty sure they're both there too.
Yep, Maury Wills leads the list with 171, and then Davey Lopes had 85.
Yeah, okay, so then 75. So Willie Davis?
Yes, with 116.
I'm still four shy, dear God. Pee Wee Reese.
Yep, 99. Maybe that's why he retired. He's like, I can't get to 100.
Yeah, it's like didn't Maddox retire with like 999 walks or something? I thought that was great. So what about Matt Kemp?
Nope.
It would be amazing if Yasiel Puig was on here in this very short time. So the long thing. Let's go. I'm going to go back to Bill Russell, actually, as the one guy who wasn't on here.
It is not. I'll let you know it is a name you've guessed today.
Yeah, but
You've guessed about half the right.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. So I don't think he got to... He didn't have the 330 years.
So you're missing three names.
Oh, Steve Sachs.
Yep, with 126. So you're missing two names.
Okay, I'm going to tap out unless you want to hit me up.
Jackie just makes the list at 76.
Hmm.
And then the name not previous mentioned, Jim Gilliam, with 111.
Ah, nice. Okay, all right.
Good job. In 2020, the number 9 spot in Dodger lineup had an 761 OPS, which through 2021 is far and away the highest in LA Dodger history. That actually tripped me. I forgot I had that. I thought he had said 2021, and I was like, oh my gosh. How Dodgers pitchers rake. In that same season, the Dodgers, who combined to be the full-time DH, had a 786 OPS for the Dodgers. Do you think that, in the end, the Dodgers who combine at DH will have a higher OPS than those who hit in the 9th spot? Ooh, that's interesting. Knowing that there could be some overlap, he adds.
Sure.
This is how National League brain I have. I was like, aren't those the same thing?
Yeah.
Oh, right. So yeah, no, that's not how it works.
Well, I just think it's generally you're probably going to have the DH be higher. Because even like the 9 spot is not always quote unquote your worst hitter,
right?
But it's generally one of the worst hitters, and it's like Austin Barnes is going to basically be the 9 hitter every time he catches almost, or like it's like the occasional Hanser Alberto start or something. Like they literally only have 12 position players right now, so like they have really run a very short bench. So like now obviously Gavin Lux could just keep continuing to rake and like produce there, but I think the DH will end up being higher than the 9 spot, but I think both will be. I mean, I don't know about the Dodgers DH spot being like best in baseball, but they have a good shot of having like the best number 9 OPS in baseball, if that's a thing.
So it'll be interesting to check at the end of the season.
Yep.
Is Eric has pointed out, more teams are acknowledging contract terms themselves in their announcements this season than ever before, and now that has extended to talking about unsuccessful negotiations in the Aaron Judge extension. It seems like it was more important for Cashman to get out in front of the narrative that the Yankees are not spending money like the Dodgers and Mets for the fan base than outline a vision for their 2022 and beyond team build. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that was... I was surprised at that. Like, so just as background, like, very rare... It has been rare for teams to like acknowledge the money always gets out anyway, and so I think there's some like sort of recognition that transparency is probably better. The Braves are publicly traded, and they always announce their dollar figures in their little sort of announcements, like we signed Kenley Jansen to a 1-year $16 million deal. The Blue Jays have been doing this for a few years. The White Sox also announce money in their deals. The Angels started doing that. There's a common theme here, like Anthopoulos was in Toronto. He's in Atlanta now. Perry Minasian was with Anthopoulos before. Now he's with the Angels. The Angels announced money in their stuff. The Dodgers, I believe, are going to start doing this, although they've only done it once because there's only been one sort of opportunity for them to do so since, is the Hanser Alberto contract. Like in the like sort of announcement, they're like, we signed Hanser Alberto to a $1.6 million contract plus a $2 million option for next year with a $250,000 buyout. And I saw that and I was staring at it and I'm like, they just did the thing, and like, you know, like, because they're generally tight-lipped about that kind of stuff, just, you know, on the record or whatever. So that was a surprise. But I will say this, so the Judge thing is different because, like you said, Cashman, during like a press conference with reporters, like said what the Yankees' offer was to Judge, the Judge turned down, and that never happens. So I think that was very clearly an attempt by the Yankees to turn fan sentiment against Judge and not them, right? Like, to take the heat off of them for not being able to re-sign their sort of superstar player. Now, there's a couple ways to think about this. There's been a couple good articles written about this. I will link to them. I believe Andy McCullough and Ken Rosenthal co-wrote one for The Athletic. Basically that Aaron Judge, like, has the hammer right now. And I believe there's a quote from Max Scherzer in there saying, you very rarely get the hammer. And when you have it, you have to use it. And he's using it now to sort of get what he thinks he deserves. I'm of two minds about this. Like, I think, yes, it's very obvious the Yankees should re-sign Aaron Judge. He's not Mookie Betts, right? Like, from a couple years ago with the Red Sox, but he's close enough to that where the Yankees really would be foolish if they let him get away. At the same time, he's also very injury prone, and the Cashman's offer, I believe, it was their arbitration number for this year, so like $17 million plus $30.5 million for the next 7 years. Like, that is a pretty reasonable offer. And then the fact that Aaron Judge has been very injury prone, like, you almost could see, like, he probably should or might take that. But I can sort of see where he doesn't, because, you know, they can offer that on the free market too, and then he can get other offers and then get a higher number or whatever. So he's sort of betting that he's going to be healthy enough this year to get that kind of a deal. So I completely see it from his standpoint, but I was sort of surprised by that. But it's very clearly that the Yankees are trying to limit the backlash to them, and at least put it out there to sort of turn the tide in their favor in the PR battle. But in the end, it doesn't. You still have to sign him, they're. I don't know if it was worth it, you know, to sort of like poison the well like that. Maybe he's going to see that as like a not bad faith, but just like, come on, man, what are you doing here? Like, don't air dirty laundry or whatever, and let's just get a deal done or whatever. But yeah, so he's made it pretty clear that they don't want to. He doesn't want to, like, talk during the season. That's why it sort of came up last week. Like, if we don't get a deal done before the season, I'm just going to go to free agency. And that looks like that's what's going to happen.
I wonder how much of the lockout negotiations influenced this, either directly. I doubted that would have come up by now. But in, like, so much of the lockout period was about the control of information. Clearly, both sides leaking certain information to the press to make their light, you know, them appear in a better light. And the Yankees move here is just kind of straight out of that playbook. They knew offer looked good, so leak the offer. But, you know, we weren't in the negotiations. We don't know why necessarily Judge turned it down. You know, we can take guesses, but curious.
It wasn't like the a couple years ago, or maybe it was last year, I don't remember, with the Astros with Correa. They offered him something like 5 years, $150 million, which is like reasonable, but also, like, you know, he's going to get like a longer deal. That was like a very clear public, we tried, but we know it's not going to work offer. I think the Yankees at least had an offer that was reasonable. But again, you can totally see why Judge wouldn't take it. I forgot another weird aspect of this is because of the late spring and some of the players who didn't come to agreement on arbitration, like, their arbitration hearings are going to be like in late May and in June. So they're like playing this season technically without a set salary. I believe this happened in 95 as well. John Becker at Fangraphs, I looked this up, and I think what they did that year was, so the player is paid for now at what the team offered, which the lower number. And then if in arbitration it becomes a higher salary, they get like made whole up to that point in the season and then going forward. But it's just like this very bizarre thing. Like, you sort of have a salary, but it's like, we'll figure it out at some point. But like, for now, you still have to play. But yeah, who knows?
Given it has only been 4 games, and this could be obvious, but watching the DH version of the game is different in so many ways than one I have watched for baseball for all my baseball viewing life. It appears that one of the challenges will be finding time for your bench, especially given the talent level of the Dodgers' current and potential depth of their regular lineup. Do you think starting next homestand, we'll start to see some sense of giving even players like Betts, Freeman, and Trey Turner a complete day off? And how much of that is difficult given the small bench?
Yeah, so it is very weird. So we're going into this Wednesday morning. So right now, Hanser Alberto has played in one game and batted once. He played late on Sunday. Given how they've sort of treated Coors Field in the past, last year they started with four games there and they gave, like, I believe every regular but Bellinger a day off from the lineup at some point during that series just to not want to overload them. I would have guessed Alberto would have started one of the games at Coors, like the Sunday game. But outside of Austin Barnes, who's now will have caught two of the games, and Will Smith did not DH in either one of them. They've had Rios DH once, and then Alberto play once, and then Barnes catch twice. So it's been basically the regulars so far. So you have a spot now where they come back home, home openers Thursday. They play seven straight games at home, so that's nine straight days with a game. So I think you'll start to see probably like a little more Alberto, a little more Rios mixed in with the consecutive day stuff, like giving like Justin Turner an actual day off instead of he's DH'd a couple times. You might see the same with Taylor, who's already gotten one day off, but you can sort of see, I think that's where it would come in, but it's definitely weird. It's just, you know, cause there's no, you know, you're not pinch hitting for a starter. And then when you take your pitcher out, it's not, you don't really have to double switch. So there's really not double switching, you know, unless it's some weird thing. So you're really just, it's almost, your bench is almost, do I want this guy for a platoon advantage at some right. point late? And that's kind of it. But yeah, so it is going to be kind of weird, but I'm not sure. I think in the next week or so, you'll see a little bit more of the offhand bench start for Rios and Alberto. But as of right now, those are the only, outside of Barnes, you know, those are the only two that like you have to mix in because it's just a tiny bench right now. So it is very weird.
I think adding to that is they definitely don't have as much outfield flexibility as they have in years past.
Right.
They also haven't had, especially over the last 2 years, the players that were such obvious platoon changes have all left, right? With Kike, with Jock, with Pollock, that all like, oh, the handiness of the pitcher really dictated when you expected them to see the lineup aren't there anymore. There's still, you know, obviously some chances of doing that this season. Going back to the question in general, the thing that's influenced me is how much, as a National League, you know, watcher, and I remember going through this in 2020, I've pinned the when is the starting pitcher coming out to, well, where are they in the lineup? And how much that would influence whether or not you tried to get another inning out of a guy or maybe they'll take him out a little early because of that. And I found myself doing it in the series in Coors, like, oh, it's the back end of the lineup. This might be the time to bring a bench bat off. Oh, right. That's not going to happen.
Right. And then I would say what you might see, at least from a platoon side, is depending on how like Cody Bellinger does, because everyone seems to be sort of watching him. He had a couple hits on Sunday, but for the most part hasn't done a ton at the plate. So you could see a situation maybe later in April or possibly into May where it gets to a point where they do pinch hit for him later with like a right-handed bat, which they don't necessarily have at the moment. But like you said, it's outfield depth. So that might be an issue where that's when you could see like a Kevin Pillar coming up, whether it's after they expand go back to the 13 pitcher maximum on May 2nd. So you have to have another bench player, or before then, if they just decide to have 13 position players instead of 12. So you would expect to see maybe someone like that who they be willing to, go to like pinch hit for Bellinger. You could still do that with like Hanser Alberto. If like Gavin Lux is at second, then you move Taylor to center and Lux to left or something like that. You could do that now, but you know, they are a little bit limited in that regard.
Snacking on something sweet is not my first thought when I go to Dodger Stadium, though I did get the occasional cookie and frozen yogurt if I was covering the game in the press box. That said, if your sweet tooth was wanting, do you think you would lean more towards the cold treat world? Ice cream, frozen yogurt, frozen lemonade, or the sweet salty area like a churro or Wetzel's pretzels, maybe caramel corn? Perhaps we should all wait for a bag of Eric's Chex Mix.
Okay, so this is just at the game?
I think that's what he's going for, yeah.
So, growing up, did they just call it a malt?
That sounds
the little block of chocolate ice cream that you had a wooden spoon. Yeah. I was never a huge chocolate guy, and that always seemed like overkill to me. So that wasn't really my thing. I did like the, if I remember right, I can't remember how often I got this, but didn't they have like a helmet with like some sort of ice cream, like a soft serve type thing?
Of course.
That seemed like a lavish treat that was very rare. I will say now I am more likely now to probably go for actually like the Wetzel's pretzels type thing. But the soft serve is nice. So they have soft serve in the press box usually. It's usually vanilla and then chocolate, and then the middle is the swirl.
Sure.
Which is fine. Very occasionally, they will have vanilla and strawberry, which is my jam. And if they have that, I will pounce. But other than that, maybe a cookie, but most likely like from stuff that's in the concessions. Wetzel pretzel sort of satisfies that itch for me.
This is pretty straightforward for me. Day game, something cold. Night game, something else.
Even if it's
candy or something like that. Although I'm definitely much more at night game going to seek out something, just, you know, like a Dodger dog, something more savory. Less likely to go into the sweet stuff. But during a day game, either the frozen lemonade, probably my top. But I am a big fan of the chocolate malt. But yeah, the Minute Maid frozen lemonade thing, also usually served with a wooden spoon. Big fan.
I don't think they do this anymore. The all you can eat. I don't remember if they still do the all you can eat Right Field Pavilion. But one of the things there was like that your sort of standard, like very generic ice cream sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice little pick me up for an in game treat. I'm trying to think too. So I'm not a coffee drinker generally, to the point where I might have, like, if it's some late game is just dragging or something, I more want to get like a Coke Zero or something for the caffeine boost. But there's been times, like, we're talking like maybe two times per season I might have coffee. Like, I literally haven't drank coffee this year so far. But sometimes in the press box, I will go and get like a hot chocolate if it's like a cold night or something.
If you were at the game in Minnesota yesterday, I think that might have been a coffee night. Cold enough. Yeah, no. You need the game. Talk about dragging.
88 minute rain delay in the eighth. Yeah, for sure. That would have been, I definitely would have had coffee if I was in Minnesota, especially in that rain. Like, just as a, you need like a warm, not pick me up is not, I guess it would be a pick me up at that point, because you're like, I need to stay awake because I'm podcasting in the morning. But no, so that's sort of where we're at. We are very measured reaction to the Dodgers 4-game start, and we'll keep watching, and we'll talk about next week after they play a couple home games, and we'll talk to you then.